You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Marty Tankliff was a teenager in September 1988, about to start his senior year in high school, when his parents, Arlene and Seymour, were bludgeoned and stabbed to death in their Long Island home. He was arrested within hours, and in 1990 he was convicted of his parents' murder and sent to prison for 17 years. He protested that he was innocent all that time, and in December 2007 he was released from prison. With me now to talk about what happened and add some new details to the what we know about the Tankliff case, a private investigator and former NYPD homicide detective Jay Saulpeter, who worked to free Marty, and journalist Richard Firstman. They've co-authored a new book about the case called A Criminal Injustice. It's published by Ballantine, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be back, Leonard.
First, can we go through the facts of what happened on September 7th, 1988? Rick, how were Arlene and Seymour Tankliff murdered?
On September 7th, 1988, Marty Tankliff was about to start his senior year of high school in Port Jefferson, Long Island. He wakes up, finds lights on, front door open, finds his father barely alive, as you said, bludgeoned, his throat cut. He calls 911. He then searches for his mother, sees that she is dead, and the police come, and within a few hours, he's being interrogated, and within a few hours of that, he's under arrest for their murder.
Well, he made the 911 call, right?
That's right.
What did he say to the 911 operator?
Well, the tape, which was played at the trial, shows you have the voice of a 17-year-old kid who's panicked. He's clearly sounds groggy, as he's just woken up into a nightmare as opposed to out of one, and tells the operator that he's found his father in this condition. She gives him instructions on what to do, and he's clear-headed enough to follow the instructions to a point.
Now, Jay, how long before he woke up was this crime committed? Do we know?
Possibly, maybe 2 hours or so. It was the
so it was really late in the early morning.
Sure, I mean it was. There was a card game the previous night, which was a card game that the father would have with his friends every month. They would switch to a different location, a different home. They left late. Marty, of course, woke up to go to school, and he woke up to unfortunately this bloodbath.
How important is it that the detective, the homicide detective, that should have on to investigate the case was James McCready?
How important? Well, it's important because James McCready showed up, Marty Tankliff went to jail, was convicted and went to jail for many years based on a confession that was inconsistent to the whole crime scene. This was a confession written by James McCready, and it's James McCready's version of the crime scene.
Well, hadn't Marty told him that he thought that a man named Jerry Stuerman had killed his parents?
He certainly did.
So were there reasons? Did Marty have good reasons for thinking that that Jerry Stuerman was a likely suspect?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there was a lot of hostility between Marty's father, Seymour, and Jerry, and Marty's father was about to ask for a great amount of money back from a loan that he gave to Mr. Stuerman.
So what was Detective McCready's response?
There was no response. The response was Marty Tankliff was brought to a police station, Jerry Stuerman was never looked at, and Marty Tankliff was arrested based on a confession that didn't fit the crime scene, and Jerry Stuerman fled Long Island about 10 to 12 days later.
And if I could just add that when people talk about he confessed a confession, he didn't really confess. It was one of the lawyers calls it a concession, and basically McCready told several very significant lies and actually had Marty thinking that he did this and didn't remember it, as bizarre as that sounds. And this is really a fabricated confession. The details were clearly, we think, fed to him by McCready. And since there was no recording of it, it was the detective's word against the defendants, and the defendant lost.
What does Marty remember about his interrogation?
You know, his memory is fairly spotty, as it is for pretty much everything that happened that day. and which is one of the things that I think has made it difficult, or did make it difficult, at his trial. He testified, and he was, he was very candid about what he didn't remember, and it was almost as if the more candid he was, the more people thought he was lying.
Jay, I'm sure you've conducted a fair number of interrogations. So when you looked over this one, what did you think? Did it smell bad?
Well, that's exactly why I took the case. When I was, when the family came to me to look at the case, I looked at, the confession, and looking at the actual crime scene, and I realized that Marty never had an investigation. That this young man is in jail because the case was never really investigated, and the confession. I mean, I've taken many confessions and many interrogations. You really would like the confession to be consistent with the crime scene. If I tell you not one thing in his confession is consistent, this is not Marty's confession.
So why didn't that come up at the trial?
It did come up at the trial, and unfortunately, we're dealing in an environment when Marty went to trial where people believed their police, where people believed the district attorney's office. And what you're seeing today, unfortunately, because of police misconduct, that's why, unfortunately, some guilty people today are getting off, because the juries today do not believe the police and the detective, specifically because of detectives like MacCready.
But hasn't MacCready been criticized for using the techniques he employed? What's been his response?
Well, he's been criticized on the fact that he lied to Marty. You know what? I'm not going to go after MacCready on that, because, as MacCready says, he's allowed to lie. He's allowed to lie to get to the truth. But you can't lie. He lied with the whole confession. I'll never concede that Marty confessed. It's impossible for Marty to have confessed to this, because when you're going to confess to a crime, and I've been there with, taking confessions, you have to know what happened. There's nothing in that crime scene that could show that Marty was aware of what happened.
Well, I want to talk about those discrepancies in just a moment, but first, my guests are Jay Salpeter and Richard Firstman. They've collaborated on a book called A Criminal Injustice about the fight to free Marty Tankleff. What were the discrepancies?
Well, in MacCready's alleged confession, he mentioned that it was a barbell. There was a barbell or a dumbbell that was used. It was never a dumbbell, and it wasn't a barbell. He also stated that the kitchen...
What do we think he was hit? They were hit with?
It's very possible a knife, a pipe, and, a garrote that, basically incapacitated Marty's father. But the main weapon was the kitchen knife that MacCready put into the confession. And would you believe that the kitchen knife only showed watermelon juice on it?
Which is not surprising, since it was next to a watermelon that the poker players had eaten the night before.
Meanwhile, Rick, what happened to Jerry Stuerman after the murders?
A week after the murders, Jerry Stuerman disappeared and winds up in California. They find him 2 weeks later. The police response was that this has nothing to do with the murders, even though they had never seriously questioned him beforehand. And could not possibly know it had nothing to do with the murders, especially since most people thought it certainly did have something to do with the murders.
So he didn't even have to provide an alibi?
He, at the trial, his daughter provided an alibi that is very suspect. In fact, Robert Gottlieb, the trial attorney for Marty, in his closing statement, called it so lame, so convenient, and which was that he came home at 3 in the morning and he had forgotten his keys. And his daughter testified that she had let him into the house, and that's how she knew he came in at 3 in the morning. But the whole disappearance to California, bizarre escapade, everybody on Long Island, I think at that point, who was following the case, thought, well, he's got to be involved. And then they go out there and assure him that he's not a suspect. They bring him back. And somehow, and I remember at the time, I was working at Newsday. I wasn't covering the case, but somehow he was persuasive enough in this role of this very erratic but harmless bagel maker that people, I think, did accept that he just fled because he was under stress about his various...
He was a bagel maker who had borrowed money from Marty Tankliff's father?
Right. He was in debt to Seymour Tankliff by about $500,000 and also had sort of turned over half the interest in his bagel empire to Seymour. And there was an ongoing dispute that just festered and festered until Seymour was being threatened. And we have a lot of material in the book that has never been out. New people who could not have testified because of hearsay rules at the trial, some who were not even people weren't aware of. And I think it paints the picture of a real ticking time bomb of that led to this. And it's just completely obvious to anybody who looks at the facts objectively.
And where is Jerry Sturman now?
Jerry is living at the Boca West condos in Boca Raton.
Beautiful gated community.
As Jay said before Marty was freed, that both Jerry Sturman and Marty Tankliff are in gated communities.
Right. But do you think he'll ever be charged, Jay?
Well, we're hoping. I don't see any reason why he shouldn't be charged, and it's not only that Jerry should be charged, Leonard. We have the whole group of people that were involved. I have no doubt that I was correct in my investigation that we uncovered the driver of the car, Glenn Harris, and the two other participants in the house, Joseph Creedon Jr., also known as Joey Guns, and Peter Kent. If I could clear up something for your listeners, why Jerry might have taken off. When Seymour, the night of the incident, Seymour didn't die. He went into a coma. He never regained consciousness, and subsequently he died about 10, 11 days later. Jerry took off because he was afraid that Seymour would come back and possibly say something.
Well, what did he say was the reason he went to California?
As Rickett said, he said it was the pressure. It wasn't the pressure. He's not going
to
leave his
family.
Gee,
every time I feel pressure, right. I want to run to California,
well,
too.
Right, well, and to a spa.
Well, he went to Esalen, of all places, and to see Jerry Sturman at Esalen is kind of an interesting image.
It's also not new. It's been said before, but when Rick explained the 911 call, when you asked Rick, it's very interesting that Marty said his father is injured. He never mentioned his mother because at that point he didn't even know that his mother was hurt. And, a detective looking at this, and many of your listeners who are savvy to investigations, Marty called 911 and he said his father was living. If Marty had taken off, everyone would have known that Marty had did this. Marty, in the time, his father was on the footsteps of death. By the time the ambulance came, Marty could have finished Seymour off. But he called for help. He called for help. Jerry Sturman fled, and Marty Tankliff spent 17 years in jail.
There's just one last thing about the Sturman leaving, because the basic story is well known that he took off, but there are a lot of details that we've developed, and one of them is that the poker players
had he been at the poker game?
Yes, and he was apparently the last to leave, the poker players in the days afterward got together, everybody but Jerry Sturman, to sort of compare notes about what did they think happened after they left. And they all knew that Sturman was a strange bird. They felt that he did it, even though Marty had supposedly confessed. And it seems that information did, well, we know that information got to Sturman because there were places where he mentioned that one of the reasons he did leave was because that he was being suspected. And he wouldn't talk to the poker players anymore, and the timing is obvious. And also, he withdrew $15,000 from a joint account that he had with the Tankliffs. They were also partners in racehorses. And one final thing is that as Jay mentioned, thinking that Seymour might regain consciousness. It seems that it was all sort of, you could lay out the facts and you see why he left.
My guests are Richard Fersman, who is an award-winning author and journalist, who's been on the show before to talk about some other matters, and Jay Salpeter, who's a decorated former New York City police detective and hostage negotiator. They've collaborated on a book called A Criminal Injustice, A True Crime, A False Confession, and The Fight to Free Marty Tankliff. It's published by Ballantine Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Richard Fersman and Jay Salpeter. Their book called A Criminal Injustice, A True Crime, A False Confession, and The Fight to Free Marty Tankliff, published by Ballantine Books. Jay, in working on this case, didn't you find new details about the relationship between Detective MacCready and Jerry Sturman?
Yes, I did, and this was also presented in our 440 hearing in Suffolk Court. Jerry Sturman and Marty's initial trial testified Detective MacCready testified in court that he didn't know Jerry Sturman. During the course of my investigation, I found witnesses that, you know, disproved that fact. In fact, we had two witnesses testify that Jerry Sturman and Detective MacCready had a prior relationship, that they knew each other. We also have a young lady, unfortunately, that wouldn't testify, but she would have been a very good and credible witness that put MacCready and Jerry Sturman together in the bagel store, also involving some drug dealings.
And why wouldn't she testify?
Well, unfortunately, some of our witnesses, you know, were very frightened of retribution from the DA's office or from the police.
She did give a statement that was written, you know, with all the details. She just wouldn't take that next step.
Now, Rick, don't you live in Suffolk County?
Yes.
Was Marty unlucky that the murder and trial happened in Suffolk County?
I think so. The background here is very important. Suffolk County's reputation was not very good in terms of homicide investigations.
The homicide squad was under investigation, wasn't it, at the time?
Right. The State Investigation Commission at the time did a very, very bold and independent investigation of the police and prosecutors generally, but really focusing on the homicide squad after a whistleblowing judge named Stuart Nam, had two consecutive murder cases in which he was convinced that there had been perjury by a police officer, even a assistant district attorney, fabrications of evidence and confessions. Stuff that was really beyond the pale, and reported this to the governor at the time, Mario Cuomo. The SIC investigated and released a blistering report about the confession rate in Suffolk County, which Newsday at the same time did an excellent series on the confession. It was called The Confession Takers, and essentially revealed that Suffolk County had a 97% confession rate with homicides, which was twice the national average.
And juries tend to believe, they tend to go along if a confession
right,
has been sure. made.
One thing to add about MacCready is that he was actually cited personally in that SIC report as having given a perjured testimony in one of those murder trials that Judge Nam reported. And MacCready did have a reputation both inside the police department and outside. And, you know, so this was, you know, Marty, almost the perfect storm of him being able to stay on the homicide squad and be the lead detective on a very sensitive case.
But, Jay, you said one of the reasons that Marty was convicted was because people tend to believe the police. Hadn't this come up in the trial, that the homicide squad was under a cloud at the time?
No, I don't believe so. Rick, could you clarify that? I don't think that was allowed to be.
It was Gottlieb, the attorney, tried to.
Was he good? Did he do a good job?
I think so. I think, yeah. and this has been on that, he did try to get get MacCready in there. He was able to actually read back his allegedly perjured testimony from the other trial and the jury would, you know, could hear it. He wanted to get much more in. He actually tried to get the 199-page SIC report into evidence, but that was not going to happen. You know, it's a very important question about Gottlieb because he's taken his licks from Marty's family, and I think that there are some legitimate points that they make, and I think Gottlieb would concede that he might have done some things differently. But the bottom line is that he did a very good job, in my opinion, and established reasonable doubt beyond what should have been necessary. And I really, you know, I think this was a wrongful prosecution, and I also think that the jury made not just a terrible mistake and misjudgment, but they really did not understand basic concepts such as reasonable doubt and the burden of proof, and through their own statements.
Well, that's also a judge's responsibility, having the jury understand those things.
Right. I think that, you know, the judge, gave them the instructions. I didn't see anything there that he didn't do that he should have. Gottlieb might disagree, although there was a key thing where the judge allowed the prosecutor to say in his closing statement, to raise questions, why didn't Marty's sister and cousin and uncle, why didn't they testify, which was clearly inappropriate.
So on June 28, 1990, Marty was convicted of the crime. How long was the sentence?
He received a sentence of 50 years to life, 25 to life for each of the murders. And had Jay not come along, Marty would be eligible for parole at age 69.
And what was life like for him in prison?
I think Jay probably can.
Yeah, and how did you come along, Jay?
I came along because I opened up a letter, one of Marty's many letters to attorneys and other investigators asking for help.
He was advocating for himself,
yes,
on a regular basis.
Always. He wrote me a letter dated December 21st, 2000, asking me to come aboard to work pro bono. I read the letter, I spoke to the family, and I told the family, and then eventually I told Marty, the only way you're getting out is if the case was solved. All of Marty's legal remedies were exhausted when I came in. So I said, Marty, if you did it, do not waste my time. I will never be able to find anyone responsible. Marty said, Jay, investigate. On December 21st, 2008, Marty was set free by the appellate court.
How many people had worked with you to clear his name?
Not too many. Me. Basically, I worked, because of there was no money involved, I worked the case myself for 7 years alone.
But then the Innocence Project did get involved, didn't it?
No.
I would bring in an investigator once in a while to help me, Charlie Haas, a crime scene expert. But basically, I'm it.
But there was a lot of money in this family, and everybody else believed in the family believed that Marty was innocent. How come?
Well, not so much money, actually. The Tancliffs left a significant estate of about $3 million 20 years ago. But as it happened, Marty, who was supposed to be the primary beneficiary, was not, and the money went to his half sister and his aunts and uncles and cousins who were with him for all these 20 years. They're all, comfortable people, but they're not, wealthy.
My guests are Richard Firstman and Jay Salpeter. Their book, A Criminal Injustice, A True Crime, A False Confession, and The Fight to Free Marty Tancliffe, published by Ballantyne Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. He did have a hearing 6 years later. And you had, I'm sure, uncovered all sorts of interesting details, Jay. How come it wasn't successful?
Well, unfortunately, when we went in there, when Marty's legal team went in there, Bruce Barkett and Barry Pollack, it's amazing that you could go into a courtroom in America, and before you actually go in, you're told by the other legal community there, you're going to lose. And I'll tell you, we lost.
But Judge Braslow, do you think that he went in with an attitude?
Oh, I think he went in with an agenda to not allow Marty to have a new trial. That's, the political environment. Judge Braslow's father was a big-shot head of the Democratic Party. He was instrumental in having Tom Spoda, the district attorney of Suffolk County, change party lines, become a Democrat, and become the DA. So, I mean, we went in there knowing, told we're going to lose.
But isn't there also a reluctance in general for the criminal justice system to go against a conviction unless the evidence is just so, just so damning? For example, if there'd been DNA evidence, and even that always work.
That's what made this even more difficult. But we came in there with, they never realized what we were going to come in with, and many of the witnesses came in during the actual time of the hearing. But, however reluctant they were, the appellate court overturned the conviction and destroyed the credibility of Judge Braslow.
But the appellate court overturned the conviction 9 years later in 2007. So there were big gaps in this story. And Marty Tankleff is in prison all this time. What were the conditions of his imprisonment?
When Marty was in prison, Marty will always say, I never felt I was in prison. He was always working in the law library, helping other prisoners, working on his every day he would wake up and work on his own defense. He has a terrific disposition. He was a fighter for his freedom. And one of the main reasons Marty is out today is because of the input that he put into his own case.
Didn't Detective McCready go on the Dr. Phil show at one point and talk about this?
Well, yes. And Jay can talk about it because he was there. I'll set it up. In 2006, the Dr. Phil show, and this was 6 months after Braslow denied the new trial, so while the appeal was working its way up. Dr. Phil does a show and invites Jay, Marty's aunt and cousin, a wrongful conviction expert, and Joseph Garacio, the teenage son of Joe Creedon, who had testified at the hearing in a very dramatic day of testimony that his father told him that he had in fact killed the Tankleffs, and told him many details, and also told him that Detective McCready had been paid $100,000 to protect the real killers. On the Dr. Phil show, they invited McCready on. He didn't want to come to California, but did agree to call in, and he was on a speakerphone. And at one point, the teenage son, Joe Garacio, was asked to tell what his father told him, and talked about this $100,000 bribe, the allegation. And Phil McGraw, otherwise known as Dr. Phil, asked McCready, was that true? And he said, no, it's not true, and if it were true, it means he lost money, because Creedon was only paid $50,000 for the murder. And Jay is sitting there, and you can talk about the reaction on the set.
It was amazing. We were almost in disbelief. And actually,
he was saying he knew a lot more about what had happened. Well, in fact, he was saying somebody was paid to commit this crime.
Right, the person that we named as one of the murderers. How does the detective that took the confession that arrested Marty Tankleff know that Joseph Creedon received $50,000 to be part of the hit? How does he know this? It was like we were sitting there in disbelief.
So that's enough to get Marty Tankleff freed, it would seem to me, and then exonerated, but that's not what happened.
No, well, at this time, our hearing, like Rick said, we were finished with the hearing. We couldn't, at that point, get a copy of the tape. We needed subpoena power, which eventually we did. By the time we received it, the appellate court overturned the conviction. But the attorney general also announced that there was a possibility that they would retry Marty. This evidence, amongst other statements by Detective McCready, which contradicts so much of his own testimony that he said on the Dr. Phil show, which was not aired, was held in abeyance by the attorneys in the event that Marty Tankleff would be retried.
Right. They edited out that comment and another comment that preceded it by about 30 seconds, in which he seemed to say that the real, as he put it, the real thing behind the murder, and then starts talking about Seymour and Jerry's problems. And it's sort of a convoluted, rambling statement, but it's very intriguing, to say the least. But it was all edited out of the show, and it's been sitting in a drawer.
Well, what's interesting about that, McCready actually agreed with Marty said that when at the day of the incident, he told it was because of a dispute between my father.
But there seems to be enough of a doubt to have gotten Marty Tankleff exonerated, and yet he hasn't been. And as far as I understand, the New York State Investigation Commission has exonerated the Suffolk County people for how this whole thing was handled. And there doesn't seem to be a new investigation into who actually killed Seymour and Arlene Tankleff.
You know, it's a shame in our society that two people are dead and the real killers are not being brought to justice because of political agendas. It's my opinion that at this point now, with the detective actually making statements, I would have hoped by now, since this information came out last week in the New York Times, that Mr. Cuomo and his office, the Attorney General of New York State, should have at least requested the tape from us or subpoenaed the same tape from CBS. And they might have, but if they are investigators, there's no reason at this point that they should not have had it.
Now, Marty Tankleff was a guest on the show this past summer when Jeffrey Toobin was sitting in for me, and we posted a link to that interview on our show page at WNYC.org. But what's happened to Marty since he's been out of prison?
Well, Marty right now is a student at Hofstra University. He'll be graduating right before the summer. And as we speak, Marty is over in Italy studying abroad.
Often this kind of experience, this sort of imprisonment, has a lasting traumatic effect. Do you think that Marty will be able to escape that?
Well, I think Marty escaped it the day that he walked out of prison. You know, we don't know the inner of Marty, but Marty outwardly hasn't skipped a beat. He's very intelligent. He's studying. He wants to be an attorney. Outwardly, he's been terrific.
Now, Rick, the Suffolk County Assistant DA told Newsday that he would consider reading this book for a laugh, but doubted that it would change many people's minds one way or the other.
Yeah, I saw the quote, and I actually wasn't surprised. The Assistant DA, Leonard Lato, who spent several years trying to keep Marty in prison for reasons that I can only guess, against all evidence, has that kind of attitude. I mean, that's who he is. And, you know, I just think it's very sad that somebody in that position would be so, you know, just so casual and blasé about something that's very, very serious.
Well, we can't say that Marty Tankleff is lucky, but a listener points out that there was an article in the Times recently about another man who had been convicted on a false confession, but then cleared because of DNA evidence. And he was much older and spent a lot more time in prison. He had lost pretty much all of his life. Marty Tankleff lost a lot, but he's still young enough to go out.
Yes. He's going to be very productive in society.
You know, you mentioned DNA, and, you know, it should be noted that these days everything is DNA. And you hear about 200 and some exonerations through Innocence Projects through DNA. So that it's almost quaint that a detective, you know, like Jay, hits the streets as the old gumshoe and actually got Marty out of prison without DNA. And it really is remarkable and so unusual.
And I want to thank both of you for being here to talk about this case. Richard Fersman, Jay Salpeter, the book Criminal Injustice, A True Crime, A False Confession, and The Fight to Free Marty Tankleff, published by Ballantyne Books.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Leonard.